Tēnā koutou, nō mai, haere mai. Welcome to Q&A. I'm Jack Tame. Today, former Finance Minister Grant Robertson reflects on his time in Parliament as he prepares for his final speech in the House.
I think I'm going to cry.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
Then I sit down with the head of arguably the UN's most politicised agency.
I have to ask you about President Trump. When
we will have that interview for you shortly. But we begin this morning with the new health minister. Dr. Shane Betty comes into the role with a workforce under huge strain. And one of his first steps as minister has been to restore health targets favoured by the previous national government. Minister Shane Betty, congratulations on your appointment. Welcome to Q&A.
Morning, Jack. Good to speak with you.
Let's start off with the health targets. Why have you reintroduced them?
Because we think health targets direct attention, they direct resources, they set a very clear agenda for where a health system might want to go. They also hold accountability. At all layers of the health system, there's accountability, and all of those things are good for health systems.
So looking at the five targets that you've put forward. Let's take a look at the emergency room waiting time. So you say that those give a snapshot of the health sector as a whole. Mm. Now, when you last had ED wait time targets, did emergency rooms game the system?
My understanding is yes, they did. There are a number of articles printed about that. For example, ramping. instead of turning the clock on when they arrive at the hospital, they would keep people in the ambulance and then the clock would start when they were moved in. So ramping was one example of gaming. Well, of course, there's ways to navigate that. The clock starts when the ambulance arrives. So with knowledge of what some of the gaming was, you can mitigate that and you can reduce it so it's not gamed as much. So I'm watching very carefully around gaming of the targets.
So there was a study, I think, by Auckland University researchers in 2019, and they found that their research established that gaming behaviour, quote, was common across all four case studies when those targets were in place. It wasn't just ramping, decanting patients to short stay units or observation beds to avoid target breaches, clock stopping, stuff like that. What will you do to stop those elements of gaming?
So if that's the article and the piece of work from Dr. Timbinsall, then he also came up with mitigations around that. As I was saying, you can start the clock at different times. And once you know what the gaming is, you can make it very clear. No, a movement from here to there is not the end of the clock for emergency department. Mm. It actually ends when the patient moves up to the ward. So they actually came up with some solutions as well. So I'm watching gaming very closely.
Yeah, I think the key recommendation was to have an independent verification unit for that in particular. Is that something that you'll be implementing?
Look, it's nothing that I've had in my work stream at this point. I think we have enough knowledge around what the gaming can look like and how we will mitigate it. It's not to say that at some point in the future I might not.
But how do you know if they're gaming if you're not independently verifying it?
Because we know we count ramping hours and I get assessment of ramping hours just by...
So the short stay units, for example, just to use this ED example, if you basically set up a room as a short stay unit, so you bring people through the ED and you say, OK, we're seeing you, we're going to put you in this room while we assess you, technically then the clock stops
is what you're saying.
So how do you check on something like that?
So there are several things there. There are a number of units alongside emergency rooms called acute medical assessment units, AMALs, or just medical assessment units. And they're actually legitimate extensions of emergency departments.
Right.
You can have emergency department staff working in both of them. I wouldn't suggest the clock stops when it goes there. That is still emergency department staff. You're still in your urgent stage. You're still in your stabilisation stage.
Right.
So I think a large part of that will be what part of the journey are we classifying as stop and start and being really clear around that.
But in principle, you wouldn't support having an independent verification unit going
to
check on
this. Oh, no, I wouldn't say that at all. What I'd say is I believe we know how to navigate what some of the behaviours are around avoiding the targets. And then if we find we've got problems, no, I'm certainly not going to take that out of the mix.
Those five targets: cancer treatment, kids immunisation, ED wait times, specialist appointment and electives. What are your targets for general practice?
Oh, immunisation. That's the primary care target. And if we look at that, that's a really ambitious target. So 95% at year two, that's primary care.
Sure, but it's not the only reason that people go to the GP, right?
No, but you can't have too many targets. You get target fatigue. So that is the one I need primary care to do well. And part of the question's been raised, is it ambitious enough? We have never, ever reached 95%. How much more ambitious could you be than never having reached it?
Sure, but I'm not disputing the merit in having a target around immunisation for kids' immunisations. I'm sure a lot of people can see that there's a lot of merit in that idea, but GPs do all sorts of things, don't they? And for most New Zealanders, it is the part of the health system, the primary care system is the part of the health system that Kiwis use the most. So why wouldn't you have broader targets for GPs?
So these are the top line targets, the five targets. Underneath that are a range of other less reported but still measured and watched. So, for example, PHOs have targets around what's called SIMS, SLIMS, system level measures. So there'll still be other targets, for example, around ASH rates, keeping children out of hospital. That's a primary care target. It's just not one of the five priority targets that I've identified.
What about a target for Kiwis just seeing their GP, if they want to see their GP?
So this may well be a target that we bring up as well for primary care. It's going to need a lot of discussion and a lot of work with primary care, particularly around workforce, before we set a target. You know, it needs to be achievable as well as ambitious.
At the moment.
It's certainly challenging.
But isn't that the purpose of a target? So that means that the targets you've introduced are all easy?
Oh, no, as I've said, very ambitious. You know, we'll struggle to get to the immunisation.
But you don't have a broad target for the part of the health system that Kiwis actually interact with the most.
Underneath that, PHOs have targets. That's part of their agreements. Mm. And they're primarily, if not solely, primary care targets.
So according to Health New Zealand, I'm putting you on the spot here, do you know how many New Zealanders couldn't get an appointment with their GP last year?
Oh, I wouldn't have that finger.
It's about half a million adults, 73,000 children. So why not structure a target around those numbers?
Look, I don't disagree, but there's also going to be a discussion with primary care as to what they think is a reasonable target. So those discussions are still to be had, particularly in the context we have at the moment with constrained workforce. So it's not a discussion that it's not a target that I would take out myself without deep discussion with primary care as to what do you think it should be, what is achievable, and what might the milestones be to get there.
So why haven't you had that deep discussion yet? Obviously, our primary workforce is under huge strain at the moment. Why haven't you had those conversations?
It is, because what primary care is telling us is stabilising the primary care environment is actually their first concern. And what that means is it's workforce, it's remuneration, it's retention. They're saying to me, stabilise the workforce, build up PHOs, do that first, and then we can talk about, OK, what might be achievable targets once we've done a good job with that.
So the New Zealand Medical Journal found that almost 80% of GP respondents around the country either closed or limited their enrolments for the last 3 years. So there are many, many thousands of Kiwis who can't actually get enrolled with a GP at the moment. Is the general practice funding model as it stands fit for purpose?
No, it's broken. It's been broken for a while. And I've talked about that for a period of time. And I think where most primary care practitioners are landing is with some of the principles from the Sapere Report 2022. And that said several things. It said that the funding that we do have doesn't go to the right place. So imagine this, you're the healthiest person in New Zealand with a certain demographic, and then you're the illest person in New Zealand. Practices receive exactly the same capitation funding for each, for the healthiest and the most ill. That makes no sense.
Which presumably incentivises GPs not to take on people who have more complex health needs.
Look, it can be. That's cream skimming is what you're talking about there. It can be.
Do you think that happens?
Look, I think practices will receive patients who are in need regardless, is my view. But it also comes back to saying where the work is done, where the complexity is where the funding should be. So that redistribution of capitation funding is one part. So
just to be totally clear, though, do you believe that the current funding model incentivises GPs not to take on people with more complex health needs?
Look, I trust my colleagues. I don't believe that they would intentionally cream skim. But I also do believe they should be remunerated appropriately where the level of work required is higher.
So when will you change that funding model?
So we're working on that right now. I think there's two parts to this. There's probably new funding and then redistribution of the existing funding. And that's quite complex because it will have implications, for example, like for VLCA practices. That part of the structure may no longer exist. And then assessing, how do you assess the complexity of a given practice? Now, the Sapere report did that with several attributes. They said we could use community services card, rurality, other measures. That's a body of work, but I don't want to wait too long because I understand that general practice.
So give us a time frame. When do you think that will change?
I would like to be thinking that in the next 12 to 15 months that we're substantively changing the structure of primary care.
What are you doing to stop nurses go to Australia?
So that's a challenge. And interestingly, the internationally qualified nurses, a large number of them actually move on to Australia, even though we've had a large number of IQNs come in this this last quarter.
Yep, they arrive here and then they immediately register in Aussie, right?
Yeah, some don't even come here. They register from the UK and don't actually set foot in New Zealand. They go straight there.
So what do you do to stop that?
I've been talking with the Nursing Council about that, and that's a challenge, how we're a stepping stone to Australia. They are the internationally qualified nurses. Maybe our greater attention should be for our domestic nurses, where we've all had investment in them. them, and they're the ones who are looking to move to Australia.
So how do you keep them here?
So that's a feature of retention. Retention has two parts to it. It has a wages and salary part, and it has a terms and conditions part. Terms and conditions are things like a scope extension, feeling valued in your job, a career over a lifetime. Those are some CCDM. Those are some of the terms and conditions. And then, of course, wages and salary, pay equity and pay parity, of course, is a feature of
retention. So what are you improving?
We're improving all of these areas because what
you're improving pay?
I'm not going to discuss specific pay negotiations, but what I will say
improving
is
all of
that
these areas.
Wages have increased by, for nurses by 14% over the recent past. Still not comparable with Australia, I understand that, but that has already improved. We've got more nurse practitioners funded to come into the workplace as well.
Right.
Scope extension for nurses.
In the election campaign, you promised $30 million to restore beds, an operating theatre, high-tech scanners at the new Dean Hospital. Mm-hmm. Are you still committed to that?
That is still a commitment. It's still a priority. There are bigger parts of Dunedin Hospital that we need to focus on, but that is still on the table.
What about the Whangarei Hospital build and the Hawke's Bay Hospital build?
They remain priorities.
Right. You will fund and build those hospitals?
They remain priorities. They're currently through business cases. They need to have that done before we get to the funding discussion.
Right, but priorities mean it'll happen under your government?
Oh, I hope so.
The Infrastructure Commission found we're going to have to spend, get this, $115 billion on hospitals over the next 30 years unless we drastically change stuff. Quote, the estimated annual requirement for new hospital buildings is almost equivalent to a new Dunedin hospital every year from 2033 to 2052. What are you going to do about that?
So that's the funding discussion, isn't it? And that would be across all of government. Health has funding needs, education has funding needs. This is the discussion of getting an economy back on track. It's a discussion of prioritising infrastructure. I'd have to say one of the benefits, even though I've rallied against the centralisation of the health reforms, one of the benefits is being able to see across the whole enterprise for infrastructure, so that DHBs who are just doing their own thing, now I can see across the whole the whole of the country. That's useful from a planning perspective, actually, and that will help us prioritise infrastructure.
I mean, what was really interesting reading that Infrastructure Commission report is of all of the infrastructure they considered around New Zealand, roads, bridges, everything, hospitals were the ones that had been most underfunded. $115 billion, $115,000 million. That is a fantastical sum. Should we expect to see significant progress from the National Party or from the National, from the coalition government over the next 3 years when it comes to planning for those future hospital
beds? Well, you've already seen our endeavours around fast-track consenting and around our infrastructure needs. So across the whole of government, you've seen our ambitions for infrastructure. And I'm pleased that hospitals then rise themselves up as being a high priority.
Yeah. In the campaign, National specified 13 cancer drugs that the government will directly fund outside of the usual PharmAct process. What's to stop the drug companies behind those drugs charging whatever they want?
So, several things. Firstly, the Cancer Control Agency determined what those medicines were, just to be very clear on that. And then, secondly, what we also said during the campaign is that we would fund that with return of the copay, the prescription copay. So, we're needing to do that first to fund it, and then we'll relook at that model. Our ambition here is to have access to more oncologics and to reduce those that they're giving in Australia.
So, yeah, I understand that.
That's
so
the principle.
Doesn't answer the question, though. What's to stop those drug companies charging whatever they want?
So we'll be consistent with the PharmAct model. We won't do anything, because this was raised during the campaign.
The whole thing is not consistent with the PharmAct model.
We won't do anything. Oh, we have plans. We won't do anything that's inconsistent with the PharmAct model, and it will be a collaboration between the Cancer Control Agency and PharmAct as to what medicines we fund.
But you have promised to fund those 13 drugs.
I have promised that we'll fund the medicines that the Cancer Control Agency has said is the difference at that point in time between Australia and New
Zealand. So let's think about how a negotiation works, right? You've said we are definitely going to fund these drugs, vote for National in the election, right? Then you get after the election where you've got to fulfil that promise, you go to the pharmaceutical companies. The pharmaceutical companies saw the election campaign. They know that you are committed to funding those drugs. What is to stop them charging whatever they like?
Oh, because they also want to bundle other drugs. That's not the one drug they may be providing. They want to be in parts of other parts of the PharmAct schedule. And so they want to be collaborative with PharmAct. They don't want to just localise on this particular medicine. They may well have other preparations that they want PharmAct to be a part of.
But why would PharmAct in their negotations consider that? Why would you
consider a whole range of products that any given distributor...
So you're saying that PharmAct will say, you overcharged us for one of the 13 drugs that the National Party promised
to fund during the campaign. Therefore, we're going to withhold funding for one of these other medicines.
Not at all. What they may well say is, look, this is a bundle of medicines that you have, and we need this and this, and this is one of the cancer medicines that we've talked about. Can we wrap all of that together?
In principle, is it good practice for politicians to dictate, whether on advice of the cancer agency or otherwise, is it good practice for politicians to dictate which medicines are funded?
Oh, we should never be choosing medicines, which is what we did not do. The Cancer Control Agency.
You still
agency
dictated it, though.
I did not. The Cancer Control Agency chose them. I did not choose them. They could have chosen a different set. They may choose a further different set. But it was their decision.
Is it a good idea for politicians to go outside of the usual PharmAc process?
It's a good idea for politicians to set directions and say, I want to reduce the medicine gap between Australia and New Zealand for cancer medicines. That is a good thing.
As someone who has given his life to bettering the health of his community, how many lives would the smoke-free legislation have saved?
So, look, I've seen numbers of 4,000 to 8,000 is what I've seen reported in the media as numbers that the smoke-free legislation may have saved. But what we've also said is, look, the smoke-free rates are coming down. From 8.6 to 6.8, one of the biggest gaps we've ever had, and we remain committed to driving them down. That's the context for the smoke-free legislation.
OK, so you remain committed to driving them down. Mm. How will you drive them down?
Oh, those are pieces of work that are still in front of committees that I can't discuss here, but looking forward to bringing that forward.
So the previous smoke-free legislation was set to come into force in July. Will your work be done by then?
We are looking to certainly have parts of the legislation that will be our solutions, our alternative solutions, up for discussion before then.
So as you mentioned, the modelling for the smoke-free legislation indicated that between 4,000 and 8,000 lives would be saved. Will your tobacco policy save more or fewer lives?
If we continue to drive down the smoking rates, the expectation would be yes, by definition.
I understand that you would be yes to what?
Yes to reducing rates.
No. The question was more
rate.
Or fewer.
Oh, we would need to model that.
Yeah. So you're telling me that you're working on smoking legislation that ultimately may save fewer lives, according to modelling, than the previous laws that were in place.
Oh, look, I need to see that modelling myself. That's not in my purview. What I've committed to is
you are the
to
health
continue
minister.
To drive down the smoking
now, this
rates.
This is an absolutely vital point.
And what's also important is that this is a collective cabinet decision. Just before you say, Shane, this is a you decision, this is a collective cabinet decision.
I understand. This is an absolutely vital point. I mean, given your expertise in this space, given your lifetime of work seeking to better the health of your communities, I want to be totally clear. Will the smoke-free work that you put in place, having scrapped the previous smoke-free legislation, save more or fewer lives than the previous legislation was modelled to save?
So that will need to be modelled on the proposals that we're bringing forward and remain committed to driving down those smoking rates. Very committed.
Will you support it if your modelling suggests that your smoke-free work will save fewer lives than the previous?
That's a hypothetical. I would need to see that, first of all, to make that sort of decision.
It's not a hypothetical.
Hypothetical. We remain committed to driving down smoking rates. We've had one of the biggest drops without that.
I understand you're committed to it, but I'm asking whether or not yours is going to save more or fewer lives. To the best of your knowledge, has your associate health minister had any contact with tobacco lobbyists?
I believe she has said no. So not to the best of my knowledge.
Thank you very much for your time. Good luck with
my
the portfolio.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Shane Beattie. After the break, reflecting on the COVID response, Grant Robertson tells us what he would do differently with his time again. Hoki mai, welcome back. On Wednesday, Grant Robertson will make his valedictory speech as he prepares to leave Parliament for his new role as Vice-Chancellor of Otago University. Robertson was finance minister for two terms and at a critical juncture in modern New Zealand history, overseeing the pandemic's economic response. I sat down with him in Parliament's Grand Hall and reflected on his 15 years as an MP. Can I be cheeky and just check if the shackles are off in this interview or not? Is taking GST off fresh fruit and vegetables a good piece of public policy?
Well, it didn't work, did it?
Is that a no?
Oh, look, I mean, I think I can understand 100% where Chris Hipkins was coming from with that. It was a way of making cost of living relief real. People will be well aware about what I thought about that policy.
Let's go back. When you made your maiden speech in the House, your granddad was sitting up in the pews. I think he was 89 years old at that time. He himself was a former Labor candidate, and you spoke about your shared ambition to make New Zealand a fairer and more equal place.
It is a big question, but if you look back at the New Zealand of 2008, when you started here, and compare it with the New Zealand of today, is it a fairer and more equal place?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no, because the big event that occurred between then and now was the 9 years of the John Key-led government. And in that period of time, what we spent as a country on the things that would make us fairer reduced significantly. And when we came in 2017, things were further back from where we were. So is it fairer because we built a lot more state houses? Yes, I think it is. We did lift a lot of kids out of poverty, and then we banged into the inflation, the big inflation spike, which has caused some of those numbers to come back a little bit, but we did do good things there. We restored the rates of main benefits to where they were at the equivalent levels before the mother of all budgets in 1991. So we did good things to make the country a fairer place. But there's an old saying in Labor Party politics that the journey to social justice never ends, and there's still a lot more to do there.
Are you a regrets guy?
Not really, no.
OK, well, reflecting on your time as Finance Minister, with the usual caveat that you felt you made the best decisions with the information you had available at the time, what decisions stand out as being things that you might do differently?
I'm not a regrets guy, and therefore I don't regret this, but I think I've changed my mind, and that's around the level of public debt that's sustainable. This is probably not going to excite the viewers enormously, but it's really important. In 2017, we had to prove our bona fides on running the economy, and James Shaw and I actually came up with the budget responsibility rules together for Labor and the Greens, and that meant that we were going to keep our level of net debt at 20% of GDP. That's historically been something governments have tried to do, and New Zealand does need a lower level of public debt than some other countries around the world because we have natural disasters and we are a small country. But keeping slavishly to a percentage like that means we're not investing enough in our infrastructure. And that's the bottom line. We should use our balance sheet more and better to invest in infrastructure. And over time, we did increase that, and you'll hear a lot from the current government about where the levels of debt are at. But what increasing our debt has done has enabled us to invest more in transport, more into health and education capital, more into the things that we need to underpin the kind of society and economy we want. And I think it's very clear to me now that if we were to ever go back down to those sorts of percentages of debt, we would be denying future generations the things that they need.
It's really interesting. You are doubling down on spending, because if you go back to that initial COVID response, right, and I think a lot of people agreed at the time that the best fiscal approach was to spend, to try and avoid the kind of horror scenario that Treasury was pointing out you could be facing, 10% unemployment, something like that. But in the years after COVID, even when the books were pretty good and unemployment was at 3 point something, you kept on delivering budgets with massive deficits. Did New Zealanders get value for money for that spend?
Yeah, I think what New Zealanders got is what we needed to do, which is invest in public services, invest in the education system, pay teachers properly, make sure we right the wrongs of the past on pay equity deals. Jack, we measure things in New Zealand as a percentage of GDP, and the reason we do that is so you can do it consistently over a period of time. When we look at the amount of money that we were spending on, you know, core crown expenses, when we came in 2017, it was 27% of GDP. It's sitting up around sort of 32, and it's going to come down a bit. If we keep spending around that 27%, that's austerity. That means there's not enough money. And when people complain about the health system, they complain about how long they might have to wait in an emergency department, they're worried about the quality of their kids' school. That's caused by us not investing enough. And so I do stand by what we did there. Were there the odd thing where, you know, things didn't play out the way we wanted? Sure, that
like
happens
what?
To every government. Well, it happens to every government,
sure.
And it's a day-to-day
basis. What stands
out
for you?
There's not a particular example, but
But it's the quality of the spend, right? You say that the spend is important when it comes to public services, but the quality of the spend is the thing that concerns a lot of critics.
So let's take a thing about hospitals, health capital. I remember Jacinda saying to me once, you know, do I really have to go to the opening of another kind of elevator? Because we were doing the basics. We were having to go back and reinvest in there. And I'd say one thing about that, which is I think we need to be clearer with people about the length of time the rebuilding, for example, of the health system is going to take. You know, we were being judged as soon as we'd done the reforms, where's the improvement? And the reality is that it's a 10-year program to get that health system back. So we could have been better around expectation management on some of that, for sure.
What about stuff like the cost of living payment?
Yeah, I mean, 98-point-something percent of the cost of living payment went to where exactly where it should have, and 1-point-something percent went to places, to people it shouldn't.
Inflationary?
No, I wouldn't say so. And if it was, no more so than any other form of government spending. This is something I want to talk about, Jack, which is the contribution of government spending to inflation. There are a lot of forces in what is causing inflation, and the political debate can be turned into a cartoon about it's the government spending that's the big factor in there. There are a lot of different forces on that, and that level of government spending on the COVID income relief payment is minuscule in terms of the whole economy and what causes inflation.
So how much responsibility do you take for the inflation spike?
We were part of a global situation where inflation was rising.
Sure, Reserve Bank plays a role as well, but what's your responsibility?
We invested significantly in COVID, and this is where you don't get to do the governing in hindsight thing, that actually we took the decisions we took, and in those years when COVID finished, budget 2022, budget 2023, we were rebuilding public services.
But you were doing things like taking money from the COVID fund to pay for cameras on fishing boats. What we were tangentially related at best.
Yeah, so that was right at the beginning, and that was part of the COVID response and recovery fund. And you do have to take yourself back, Jack, to those times. We were thinking about a situation where not only were we going to have to respond to COVID, but we were going to see the economy really slow down. And we did invest in a number of areas that were about stimulating recovery. I stand by those decisions. And actually, when you go out into provincial New Zealand and you see some of the things that we did, they've had really good, positive benefits.
I guess the point at large is that at some point, all of that debt, which you think needs to be higher than you initially thought when you took over as finance minister, has to be repaid. And the debt has to be repaid by younger generations who don't have the benefit of the assets that older generations had. And those are the older generations that benefited from massive asset inflation, in part because of your policies and the COVID response.
We definitely have to spread the cost of investing in important assets over a long period of time.
Do you accept that fundamental point? That one result of New Zealand's economic response was a wealth transfer to homeowners who are overwhelmingly likely to be older, while tens of billions in debt is going to have to be repaid over younger people's working lives. Do you accept that point?
I accept the first part of that point particularly. I do accept that, because one of the things that happened was that in making sure that we bolstered the markets in New Zealand, it did have the effect of those who already have assets seeing those assets rise in value. Again, I'd invite you to have a look around the world and see whether that was really any different anywhere because of the way money markets work. But remember, we were getting reports March, April 2020 that told us that financial markets around the world were collapsing, bond markets weren't actually going to be able to respond, and we did need to do what we did. Now, you've pointed yourself out, the Reserve Bank made those decisions, we gave them the tools to make those decisions. But when you look back and you look at it now, it's a very different view from where we were in 2020. The other thing I would say is by far the greatest beneficiaries of the fiscal response were workers and small business owners and sole traders, because they were the people who actually got their businesses to be able to carry on. The big businesses, sure, they got some benefit. The homeowners, they got some benefit. But when you actually break down the numbers, small businesses, people keeping their jobs and having sole traders, artists and others who could actually access that funding, they're the ones who really benefited.
The Welfare Expert Advisory Group recommendations, tax reform, Three Waters, the Māori Health Authority, the resource management reforms, income insurance, Auckland Light Rail, Te Pūkenga, media reforms. A lot of people will look back at the previous government and note that even with an historic majority, there is a huge amount of stuff you either didn't tackle or ultimately didn't stick. Why?
Well, some of those things didn't stick because we lost the election. Some of them didn't stick because the economy didn't grow the way that we wanted it to, and there were other priorities that had to come along. And you have to accept that when you're governing. Some of that COVID got in the way and meant that we didn't get as far on a project as we would have liked. It is the reality of being in government that not everything you try ends up finishing. You won't want me to do it now, but I can start doing the counter list of the number of state houses and the number of apprentices.
Sure, but those are massive projects, though, right? And I suppose the unique thing is that you had a majority, and I can only imagine that from your position over the last couple of weeks, it has been a pretty galling experience to sit there and watch the sword of Damocles fall on all of those big projects. Are there lessons for the Labor Party in the future when governing that would make some of those big reforms more likely to stick?
I'm always really interested by what people think the mandate was that we got in 2020. And when we got a mandate on the basis of a policy platform that we put forward, it wasn't a mandate just to do anything. Just because we had the majority didn't mean we could go, forget what we campaigned on, let's just do a whole lot of other things. We had a particular mandate and we tried to drive forward on that. In terms of what the lessons are that are learned, I do think it's valid to say we probably bit off more than we could chew. But that's the nature of being in the Labor Party. And funnily enough, it's one of the reasons why I like being in the Labor Party, is because we do chase down the big issues that need to be solved. And ultimately, this government will need to resolve Three Waters. They will need to work out how the vocational education system can work better. We will, over the long term, have to think about what we do to create something more permanent for people when they lose their jobs. Those things aren't going away. And I'm proud to have been part of a Labor government that had a go at them. Didn't succeed on all of them, but did a lot of other good things in the meantime.
Upon reflection, do you think there was too much of a focus on maintaining political capital at times at the expense of progressing enduring change?
That is a very tricky balance. You do have to maintain political capital, because one of the answers to the question you've just asked me is, why didn't we finish things? It's because we got voted out after 6 years, not nine or not 12. So you're always trying to balance, how do we make sure that we can stay here and how do we make sure that we can achieve change? And there will be occasions and people who will say, you should have done this, you should have done that. I remain proud of what we did, but there's definitely unfinished business.
So do you think you struck that balance right?
I think for the most part, yeah.
There were times when you didn't?
Oh, there were times when it was hard. I mean, people know. I mean, I proposed the income insurance scheme. You know, there are things that I wanted to see happen, the taxation changes. But I'm also realistic, Jack, about the world that we live in and the fact that we've got to bring New Zealanders with us if we want to make these changes.
Being the political boffin you are, do you think if you'd gone to the election with those tax changes as you wanted them, the result would have been any different?
I don't necessarily think Labor would have won.
But do you think it would have been different?
Might have been slightly different, but I don't think Labor would have won.
How different? Just explain how you think it would have.
Look, my view is that I think had we been able to go forward with a more concrete tax policy about where we were going, that would have seen, you know, some people receive tax cuts on the basis of others, particularly the wealthier, and pay more, that would have given us something very concrete to campaign on. But like you say, I've been around politics a long time. I've been through a lot of elections. Mm. My gut feeling is Labor still would not have won the election.
After the break, was Grant Robertson's political career ultimately held back? Hoki maithi, we welcome back to Q&A. While it was pretty rare for him to talk about it that much in public, Grant Robertson is the most senior, openly LGBT politician in New Zealand history. Twice you formally stood for your party's leadership, 2013 and 2014. This is a bit of a delicate question. Do you think if you weren't gay, you would have been leader of the Labor Party at some point?
It's a really tough question to answer. I'm not so worried about being delicate. I think in 2013, it was an issue in the campaign, internally within the Labor Party. And I do think it probably affected that, although whether I would have been able to win that one even without that, I'm not sure. By the time we got to 2014, it was less of an issue the second time round, but it continued to be there. But I'm not going to dwell too much on that. I think New Zealand's changed a lot in the decades since then, which is great. I still think there's some distance to go for us to get to a place where people can be who they want to be, live their lives freely and be appreciated for who they are in New Zealand. But in a political sense, yeah, I think a lot's changed in those 10 years.
Did that affect you? It must have affected you after that time, if you felt that that was like maybe a determining factor.
I'm not sure I'd say determining. I'm trying to be really straight up with you, so to speak, on this, which is that it was a factor, I know that, but I'm not sure it was everything. There was a lot of other things that
Except
were going on.
Except the margins,
well.
Especially in 2014, by which you lost,
were very small indeed. Look, the day after I lost that 24 leadership election, I remember sitting down and saying, I'm not going to do that again And I actually didn't come to politics to be the leader of a party. I came to achieve some things in some areas, and I'm going to focus on doing that. And then I became the finance spokesperson, which gave me an amazing opportunity and privilege to be able to work on those issues. And I genuinely put it out of my mind. And then when Jacinda took the leadership in 2017, I was able to be there and support my friend in doing that. That was all enormously fulfilling. And so I'm not sitting here thinking much about what happened in 2013 or 2014.
When Jacinda Ardern announced she was going to stand down, come on, you must have considered it.
Oh, for sure, absolutely.
And so what was the determining factor? Did you poll it?
No, I don't know if the party did, but I certainly didn't.
You don't know if the party did?
I don't think they did. They didn't have time. Look, Jacinda, and as is on the record, Jacinda and I had been talking towards the end of 2022 about what she wanted to do. And so clearly I also went away over the summer to have a think about what I wanted to do. And I'd been up close to that job, and I knew exactly what it took to do it, and I knew that I didn't have that. I wanted to contribute still, but I knew what that job meant for me, for my family, for the commitment that was required, and I knew I didn't have it. And I thought it would be dishonest to chase a job that I knew I couldn't give the 110-120% that was required. And I was also confident in Chris Hipkins' ability to do the job. So I went through all of that, and of course I thought about it, but in the end, you know, I felt the right decision for me, for my family, for the party, was not to put myself up.
We hosted three Women's World Cups under your watch, the Rugby, Cricket and Football World Cups codes, in which the men's game has traditionally dominated. Was there pushback that we didn't see from those who felt that hosting women's events wasn't really worth it?
We've never had a women and girls in sport strategy until we became government and I became minister. And there was pushback from some within the community about all the elements of that strategy. Hosting the big events was one of them. But one of the other things we did was ask all national sporting organisations to have at least 40% women on their boards. There was definitely pushback on that. And I felt really
from which codes?
Oh, I'm not going to say which ones, but I felt really vindicated when I was at an event last year in a fairly traditional code, and one of the board members came to me and said, "We make better decisions now because we've got that diversity on our board." And we did link it to funding, and there was one, Rugby, who didn't quite make it, but they have now. And I'm really proud of all of that. Those events, those pinnacle events, were incredible. But the stuff that actually gives me the most pleasure is when I see the player numbers that have increased in girls' cricket and women's football and women's rugby. And I love sport. It's such a great way of bringing our communities together. And I always felt uncomfortable if we were sort of excluding half the community from that amazing opportunity. And I think we've done amazing things, more to do, but I'm really, really proud of that work.
When you first became the finance spokesperson, you thought a lot about the future of work. Social insurance is perhaps a material policy that evolved from some of that thinking. How do you think that AI is going to disrupt the future of work in New Zealand?
It's huge, and every industry, including the one I'm going to in terms of universities, has to be clear-eyed about where AI fits. We can't stop it. There's no way of saying we're not going to engage with it. We have to engage with it as a country, and as, in my case, in the universities. I think the beauty of that Future of Work project was the thing that I heard time and time again from CEOs and others was the technical knowledge wasn't so much what they cared about. What they cared about were the skills that the people brought, the so-called soft skills. You know, are you good at analysing problems? Are you resilient? How do you work with others? Can you see something, a creative solution? I want to look at AI in that way and say, well, it's here, we have to obviously put regulation around it, do what we need to do, but let's focus on how we create the great human beings who are going to be able to use AI for good.
What more would you have done on wellbeing?
Some of it's quite technical, but
give us the broad themes.
Yeah. I'd like to see government departments work together a lot more on the big, messy, complex problems the world's facing, you know, climate change, child poverty, housing. We started that work.
The stuff's still pretty siloed, right?
It is, very. And, you know, but where we have brought people together, we've seen great outcomes. We now fund all of our justice agencies, you know, police, the Ministry of Justice, courts, corrections, on a three-year rolling basis with one set of priorities. And it was an amazing thing to be part of, you know, to hear the police go, we don't want that funding, we'd rather it went here to prevent someone ending up in front of us. New Zealanders don't care which agencies are providing the services that they get. They just want them provided. And that breaking down of the silo on the basis of what are the key things in our well-being, we made some really positive starts, but that was a COVID interruptus moment for us. And I really hope, despite the fact that it might be associated with me or with Labor, that the current government actually does carry that on.
You said you didn't have the gas to take on the PM job. But you do have the gas to be the Vice-Chancellor of a major university. What is it going to take to get the tertiary sector in New Zealand sorted?
Better collaboration. We're a small country. We've got fantastic universities, actually, and we actually, relatively speaking, rank quite highly in the world in them. But that small country needs to see those universities build on their strengths and work together more, and then take that out to the world as well. Secondly, I think we've got to really value tertiary education and the staff who work within it. We've got extraordinary people, Jack, and I know you do interviews around the country. The connection between the business sector and our tertiary sector needs to improve. But the amazing work that's done by our researchers and our teachers and our university needs to be highlighted. I've got a big job to do at Otago. Everyone knows that there are stresses across the university sector financially, but there's so much opportunity. And I think if we can actually get a more collaborative sector going, we'll go a long way to harnessing that opportunity.
Outside of your caucus, who is the best debater in the House?
Outside of the Labor caucus, James Shaw.
How's it going to feel standing up there for the last time? Are you a sentimental kind of guy?
I think I'm going to cry.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I've been drafting up my valedictory speech, and there's bits of it that I think are going to be interesting to deliver. I've been in and around this building for two decades. I've been thinking about the political world for a long time. I care about what we do here, and I'm ready to go, but that doesn't mean it doesn't make me emotional thinking about leaving.
What bits are going to make you cry?
You'll have to watch the speech, Jack.
Thank you very much. Good luck.
Cheers.
It's former Finance Minister and former Deputy Prime Minister Grant Robertson. After the interview, we took a few minutes and he showed me one of his favourite spots in Parliament.
Where it's
a spot most people don't see. It's called the Rainbow Room, and it celebrates contributions of LGBT MPs from across the political spectrum and the progress that has been made from homosexual law reform through to same-sex marriage. You can see that exchange on our YouTube page. After the break, it's not often you get an eye roll from the head of a UN agency. Find out why in a moment. Women and girls' health and reproductive rights are absolutely central to the progress of humanity. That's the view of the UNFPA, the United Nations Population Fund, which works to end things like gender-based violence and female genital mutilation while improving maternal and reproductive health. The head of the UNFPA was briefly in New Zealand this week, and I asked Dr. Natalia Carnham to assess progress for women around the world.
This is a momentous year. 30 years from a big meeting in Cairo, the International Conference on Population and Development, where member states of the United Nations all declared that putting women and girls at the center of development was a good idea. And in fact, in those 30 years, we've seen huge progress. And we want to claim the joy and happiness for families that fewer women are dying during childbirth, for example. And there's a lot of good things that have happened in the interim. Yet and still, it's 2024, and we find ourselves in a place where we have to defend the rights and choices that women and girls and everyone actually would make about their reproductive health and well-being.
Where are your most prominent concerns in terms of regions around the world?
You know, it's an exciting time, Jack, because, like, right now, the world is at a juncture where if you are fortunate enough to have peace in your country and in your neighborhood, you're making giant leaps ahead. I mean, think about technology and telemedicine. You know, you can train a midwife to be able to deliver a baby, to be able to give counseling over the phone, over a tablet. Parenthesis, there are also dangers of misuse of technology. And what worries me a lot is that while we've made human progress in medicine, and being a doctor myself, very proud of some of the new interventions we can make, we're taking some steps backwards in terms of especially gender-based violence, violence in the home, and, of course, the big piece, war and peace.
What are the most prescient issues facing women in this part of the world? And by that, I mean in the Pacific region broadly.
Well, you know, what a beautiful region, and really proud to be in New Zealand as we celebrate this 30th anniversary, because there's a harmony to your region that I actually admire. And I think New Zealand and the Pacific nations, the coherence that you have, the way that you work in concert, that's really good for women and girls. It's good for boys and men and for everyone as well. I worry a lot about two things. One is the Sustainable Development Goals on health. We're seeing some backtracking where I would wish we would be moving forward. One pride that the region can have is that many more women and adolescents, if pregnant, are delivering in facilities rather than struggling at home, going through labor with dire consequences. So that's really good because you've got those challenges of being able to transport people safely. One thing that I also emphasize is that the young people of this region are looking ahead. They're looking to a future of self-sufficiency, of being able to have the ability to work together. And this point about respect for people and gender-based violence is crucial for the region. It's crucial for the world. But I think we do see some high rates of violence in the home. And we want to make sure that young men, sports guys, whoever, your parliamentarians who are well aware of these issues, that men speak up to say, respect women and girls, let's put an end to violence, and let's bring peace into the home, in the communities, and into our countries.
Religion plays a really, really significant role in many Pacific countries. How do leaders in those countries and those communities feel about efforts to improve access to things like contraceptives?
Well, you know, part of the beauty of being in a family, a biological family, but also a family of nations, is that religion is an expression of your identity, of who you are. It's something that people hold very close to their hearts. And the beautiful thing about religion is it encourages people to work together, to look for solutions. So whether it's a question of contraception, a woman is going to look for guidance from her religious community. And here, UNFPA works very hard in concert with many of the religious groups at the local level to give a good explanation of why it's protective if a woman can choose how to space her children, when to time her children. And it's interesting that your reproductive years, when you're making a family, are the same as your productive years, when you're out there working in the workplace, in your farm, whatever you're doing. So again, this is life-saving information. It's also an expression of caring to allow people to choose what's right for them, and their faith is a big part of that.
But how is that message received in the Pacific?
Well, you have a lot of variability in the countries of the Pacific. And I would not dare to say that there's universal agreement on a lot of the issues on reproductive health and reproductive rights and reproductive justice. So UNFPA, working with the governments of the Pacific, the leadership, up to and including businesses, you know, whoever it is that we can ally with, we have the advantage of having been in the region for quite a while and working closely, for example, with the family planning associations, including Sexual Health and Well-Being Aotearoa here in New Zealand. So we tailor our programs pretty carefully in concert with people on the ground who know what are the big issues and where do we focus. We focus, for example, on helping teen girls not to become pregnant, because we have a whole wealth of evidence that shows if we help to protect her, if we can inspire her to finish her education, it's going to be better for her as an individual, but also for the entire family. And there are economic benefits, but there are also benefits for her to be able to show her leadership. So giving young people the respect that they're asking for and entrusting them with information, not leaving them being ignorant, right? But also being sure that we work in age-appropriate ways that guides. And again, this is for the guys as much as for the girls, right? It takes two. So we want to be sure that we explain at the right time how family life education is going to really help to make stronger communities.
You've been meeting with the ministers of health and social development in New Zealand. What was your message to those ministers?
Well, I'm here for a period, and I have already met with Acting Minister of Women's Affairs, and I'll be meeting with the Minister of Health. Very excited to be in New Zealand. You know, you're a big partner of the United Nations on the world stage, and obviously a lot of your success, the way you've managed some health crises up to and including COVID, have been examples for the rest of the world. My message is a big message of thank you to the government and to the people of New Zealand who express international solidarity in really practical ways, like contributing to the logistics of getting contraceptive supplies across the broad Pacifica region. You need to plan. You need to have people who are enthusiastic, but also know the details so that when the medicines arrive, they're current, they're not going to expire. We've got the transport chain. So these are some of the details that make a difference from wishing that things are better to actually concretely working together to improve lives, especially for some of the island communities. You know, the logistics is a challenge, and we really appreciate New Zealand's international solidarity.
I have to ask you about President Trump. When, sorry, when he was in office, his administration suspended funding, claiming the UNFPA supported, quote, a program of coercive abortion or involuntary sterilization. Obviously, your agency strenuously denied those allegations. But have you made contingency plans in case Mr. Trump becomes president again?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, we work with our member states under their guidance, and it doesn't really matter to the United Nations who is in power in a particular administration. However, you have correctly observed that in the United States, which is a huge funder and supporter and actually an originator of UNFPA, we're 54 years old now, the Republican administrations tend to restrict funding specifically targeting UNFPA because of our insistence that really, as part of human rights, your sexual well-being, your ability to choose is fundamental. We have every evidence in the world to prove that point. But again, it's an issue of dialogue. For me, speaking personally, it's lamentable when the USA withdraws funding to help preserve life. Maternal mortality is such a big issue in the world, and part of the reason for this is that sexual and reproductive health and rights are not universal. New Zealand has an advantage where we've studied your maternity programs. That's built in. You know, your health insurance is not an issue when you're pregnant. I'm so sorry to tell you that's not the case for the majority of the countries in Africa, for example, where a lot of maternal death occurs. In Afghanistan, in Myanmar, these are huge challenges. So always, as a doctor myself, I'm quick to point out that we can't wish the world to be a certain way. We have to proceed on scientific evidence. We have to proceed on the knowledge that communities have that's been hard won over time. And UNFPA will never back away from the proposition that, you know what, women are really smart, they have rights, and they should be allowed to express those rights in every way that they see fit.
That's Dr. Natalia Carnham. Hey, so you know, as well as watching our show on TVNZ+, you can find all of our interviews on YouTube. Just search NZ Q&A and we will pop right up. Hey, our Q&A, we're back after the break. Kua mutu, that is Q&A for this week. From the team, thank you for watching and thank you for your feedback. So you know Dr. Shane Retty is on Marae this morning. Hei te rā wiki. We will see you next Sunday at 9 a.m.
Q&A is made with the support of New Zealand On Air.